Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and that was the sound from Tahrir Square earlier this month as Egyptians celebrated Mubarak stepping down. Presumably caught up in the midst, journalists from around the world reporting the story of that revolution. But they have also become a part of the story. More than observers, they have become, in too many instances, the victim of violence. We have blogged about that on itsafreecountry.org. When the original reports came out of Egypt in the early February, Katie Couric leaving Cairo saying it wasn't safe for reporters to be out on the streets, Anderson Cooper tweeting from there that he was kicked and punched repeatedly, NPR's Lourdes Garcia Navarro also attacked. But days later, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who had been subjected to earlier threats by, quote, pro-Mubarak thugs armed with machetes, straight razors, and clubs, tweeting that he was beginning to feel embarrassed by all the attention journalists were receiving when the real story was Egypt. The journalism story died down for a bit, until this week when CBS chief foreign affairs correspondent Laura Logan reported that she was sexually assaulted in Egypt. Also this week, ABC News reporter Miguel Martinez beaten in Bahrain as the wave of democracy protests moved to that country and beyond. I'm joined now by Frank Smith. He is the Washington, D.C. representative for the Council to Protect Journalists, and he joins us now from Washington. Also joining me is Maryam Ishani. She is a journalist for Reuters. She has been on the ground in Cairo reporting from Tahrir for all of the last several weeks. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
First, Maryam,
I
want to start with you there in Cairo. We see now that in Bahrain, security forces have fired tear gas on thousands of protest marchers in Bahrain's capital after angry calls to topple the monarchy there. I realize that you are in Cairo. What is the situation in Cairo as the push for democracy continues there?
Well, today was a day of kind of remembrance for many of the victims. So there was a call for a million people on the streets to remember the victims of the revolution or people who died during the revolution, and that was happening all over the city today. I guess the continued conversation online as well as on the streets is what happens next, with the military essentially running the country at this point, but many decisions needing to be made about changes to the Constitution, as well as the role of law enforcement and the protection of the press and independent reporters, Egyptians and international. And that's still going on right now.
And I understand, to the point of this conversation, that on February 2nd, you were assaulted there in Cairo. What were the circumstances of your assault?
Well, February 2nd was the day I think that most of the world knew was the day that the harassment of journalists kind of became a hunt for journalists. And I had been hearing that in crowds, people were asking for Al Jazeera. They were looking for Reuters, some of the more well-known networks on the ground. And the government had at this point shut down Al Jazeera's operations in Cairo, Arabic language operations in Cairo. So there was that in the air, but on Wednesday was the day that it really shifted, and reporters came across pro-Mubarak crowds or just crowds that, you know, it was hard to know who or what they were affiliated with, but who were hostile to journalists. I myself was attempting to be in Tahrir as someone who is, I'm Iranian with a Canadian passport, but I look Egyptian, so I thought I would be safe in Tahrir, whereas I'd had to leave behind two colleagues, a German-American journalist and a French journalist who were visibly foreign. They left me with their equipment to go into Tahrir alone, thinking I would be okay on my own because I blend in, and just was stopped almost immediately by a little crowd, an ad hoc checkpoint that had popped up all over the city. This is something that was ubiquitous at this point, little checkpoints of people asking, stopping you and checking the contents of your bag. Before I even had the chance to kind of answer them, they had pulled my bag off my shoulder and were going through it, had found my camera equipment, And the leader of the unit just put his arm across my chest and just threw me back against the wall, kind of to detain me and tell me I wasn't to move until others joined him. And at this point, he was just kept asking me, Inti Masri, are you Egyptian? And I didn't answer, knowing my Arabic would give me away. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, knew I needed to kind of leave before the crowd got bigger. At this point, it was probably only six people, and I wanted to make sure the crowd didn't get larger. And so I attempted to just barrel my way through. I thought, I'm just going to walk out of here. And I was immediately hit by that same leader of that checkpoint, a man maybe in his 50s, hit me with a policeman's baton in the stomach. And I just doubled over and kind of was immobilized for a few seconds, not even really sure that what had just happened. And the crowd was immediately just, it elevated, it escalated almost immediately, the fact that he had hit me. And I don't remember a lot after that point or even how long it went on for, but I covered my head with my arms and I was repeatedly hit with either sticks or whatever clubs that people were carrying at that point. I could see that people were taking things out of my bag. And finally, a soldier did come over with a couple of civilians who kind of just got the attention of the crowd for a moment. The crowd had become about 20 people, 15 to 20 people. I couldn't really tell at this point. I could only see feet. And I just seized the opportunity to grab what was left of my bag and run, which I did, literally just ran from the crowd while the crowd did give, a few members of the crowd gave me chase for a little bit. Until I was far enough away that I could call someone and ask someone to come find me.
And how long did it take you to recover from this beating?
I was, wary for until maybe, you know, Mubarak resigned. I was, you know, my nerves are rattled. I think I'd never been more anxious in any assignment as I have been here in Cairo. And I've worked in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 3 years. So my nerves are pretty rattled all the way up until the very end. But physically, I had suffered some internal bleeding and bruises that I took a good maybe 4 or 5 days to clear up. I was physically not really able to work for another 2 days.
And forgive my asking, but do you and your editor still consider you to be a fair and impartial broker of the story?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Can you still be fair in covering the story?
I think so, absolutely. I think, you know, what was happening to the press wasn't something that was pulled out of the sky. If you look at the situation in Egypt closely as this, you know, this movement mobilized over the last 5 years, the press were definitely a part of the story going back. And to be fair, the government had reasons for feeling that the foreign press on the ground were international agents of some kind of agenda. And, you know, to be fair, that I think that's part of the story that needs to be told, is that there were reasons why the government went after international journalists. That's part of the story. So you can definitely try to look at why journalists were so targeted in this particular situation.
All right, let's do just that. Frank Smith, again, Washington representative for the Council to Protect Journalists. Let's have you help us to understand that. Give us some background on why it is that journalists were targeted in a new and troubling way in the course of this story, or was this new and different in some way?
Well, what we've seen are authorities and people associated with authorities in a number of nations through the Middle East, as these uprisings have spread through the region, wanting to eliminate witnesses to events on the ground, wanting to prevent camera crews and other broadcast journalists and print reporters from being able to document the protests demanding democracy and other reforms in these various nations. So at a certain point, authorities began and people associated with them, often plainclothes police in the case of Egypt, attacking journalists. And one thing that we've noted at the Committee to Protect Journalists is that these attacks have been quite non-discriminatory. Journalists from Al Jazeera have been attacked. Journalists from Al Arabiya have been attacked. Romanian journalists have been attacked. Polish journalists and of course Western journalists that we're more familiar with have been attacked. And now as the unrest is spreading to other nations, and you're seeing protests in other nations, you're seeing authorities in these other nations like Bahrain attacking journalists. In Libya, where a blogger had police come into his home and seize his equipment. In Yemen, where journalists have been beaten and had equipment seized. Even in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, or the Kurdish area, speaking areas of Iraq, where authorities have been faced with new demonstrations and have been attacking demonstrators, and at the same time, journalists who are attempting to cover these demonstrations and clashes. So what's clear is that this unrest seems to be taking authorities in a number of countries by surprise. They are attempting to silence the press, to eliminate witnesses who are attempting to document these events, and that is why journalists like Miriam have been attacked. And Miriam, I must say, you said that with a great deal of composure, and I'm very glad that you're okay.
Frank, I'm sure you saw, and Miriam, perhaps you did as well, the article in the New York Times today about your sister organization and the Committee to Protect Journalists. And
Jamie, I represent the Committee to Protect Journalists. The council that you referred to, I don't believe exists. I am the Washington representative and journalist security coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Oh, excellent. Well, then even better. The article points out that the committee cannot protect all journalists, that it's an impossible assignment. And surely you would agree. So what then is the best hope? What then is your best hope in this current mission, especially when Miriam points out that reporting on the story of the reporters as they are attacked, as they try to report the underlying story itself, is so terribly difficult? What is the best hope as you endeavor to pursue your mission?
Well, objective is to raise the cost against perpetrators who would seek or use violence or other means to silence or restrict the press. Authorities and other actors seek to restrict the press in the hope that they can keep their wrongdoings and other activities in the dark. If journalists are attacked with impunity, then they pay a low cost for these kinds of actions. But if we can bring attention to the fact that journalists are being physically attacked or otherwise restricted in a number of different ways, then it raises the cost of these governments and other actors. And very few governments in the world are impervious to such criticism. They seem to respond. They're attacking the press in these nations because they don't want witnesses to what's occurring. So we are, if you will, witnesses to those witnesses to make sure that if journalists are attacked, that we're still publicizing those attacks against those individual reporters and news outlets.
So give us the bigger picture, because Miriam is here. She's given us the view from the ground. And of course, we hear about the celebrity journalist Anderson Cooper and Katie Couric. But we know from your organization that there are so many more journalists, even before 18 days ago or a month ago, who were attacked in countries beyond Iraq and Bahrain and Egypt, or journalists who are killed every year. By my count, and please correct me if I'm wrong, 87 died in 2010 covering conflicts around the world. I mean, give us the bigger picture of how dangerous a profession this is.
Well, one way to look at it is that a journalist is killed around the world, somewhere around the world, every 11 to 14 days. The average shifts over the years. But on average, over the past 18 years or so, it's about one journalist being killed every 11 days. Moreover, the overwhelming majority of the journalists who are killed on the job, nearly 3 out of 4, are outright murdered. Not killed even in crossfire, but murdered by gunmen on the back of a motorcycle, that kind of thing. And the impunity rate, the rate at which the killers get away or the murderers get away with murdering journalists, is close to 90%, or about 88% on average. At the same time, you've got about 150 journalists in prison around the world in every given time, and nearly half or more than half of those journalists now are imprisoned on anti-state charges, accused of collaborating with terrorists or engaging activities like espionage, subversion, or other very vague charges like incitement. So so governments have a variety of ways, from violence, which occurs more often in democratic or open societies, to direct censorship and imprisonment, which occurs more in authoritarian states, to restrict the press, along with a host of methods in between, from controlling advertising revenues to other forms of restrictions.
I want to come back to Miriam Ashani, because she's there on the ground, suffered this horrible attack. Of course, Miriam Mubarak was toppled, but you now have a military regime there. You describe an attack that happened at the hands of military police, or men who appeared to be military policemen, with soldiers standing nearby, and you scrambled to safety and, you know, took your life back at your own hand in a moment of good fortune. How safe can you now feel knowing that full democracy has not yet come to Egypt, and yet there you are still on the ground in Cairo?
Well, I would add that the threat against journalists continues definitely in Egypt.
Yes.
I was arrested about on February 7th, and since I was released after that arrest, that I continue to receive threats through my cell phone, actually through text messages and through Facebook, from police officers. Who tell me that they're going to find me. I've changed the location of my apartment, mm-hmm. and I've received calls even in the middle of the night last night, similar threats. So the threat against journalists continues in this kind
Miriam,
of like
can
a,
you,
a small way.
Can you describe, can you quote some of those threats specifically?
Yes, I was told, because I denied, when I was first detained on the street, I didn't say I was a journalist. I just said I live in Egypt, and I did not pretend I couldn't understand anymore to get any further in the conversation. Once I was released, I received messages that they knew I was a journalist through Facebook, and that they would find the truth out about me. These are the words that I'm taking from the messages, that they had been to my apartment. I'd already left my apartment at this point, not feeling safe in my neighborhood anymore, and that they knew I wasn't there anymore, and that they would find me, and when they did, I would be in trouble. And these are messages I've heard other journalists have said that they received through text messages or through Facebook messages from people who are police. And I've reported those names and those phone numbers to my colleagues at Reuters, just you know, in case like a case could be built. But I would add, I think I would say that, you know, the attempt to kind of squash the press is an attempt to, as we said already, that the attempt to, you know, squash information is an attempt to shut down knowledge getting out of the square, the proverbial square. But I think empowering journalists on the ground and letting, you know, the governments know that this isn't just a power that's in the hands of foreign press, that local bloggers, local civilians are giving information out, that they're continuing to report, that if you want to stop the movement of information, you're going to have to shut down the whole square. These technologies have become ubiquitous. And I think if we continue to empower that, if we continue to allow voices on the ground to speak louder, I think the pressure off of international journalists will be lifted, because governments and authorities will have to face just how open information is now.
Well,
it's not working, the attempt to just kick out the blonde, blue-eyed press, or even, you know, Egyptian press or whoever. It's not just formal press anymore.
Well, and they can't shut down, can they, Miriam, every Twitter account and every Facebook page?
No, they can't. And there are several companies now. Transterra Media is a company that I work with that connects people with cell phones or just non-professional content to international networks. And this is a way that I think Egypt really came out of this experience with one very important lesson in democracy. They effectively blockaded international press from Tahrir on the night of February 2nd and in the days following. But Egyptian citizens in the square continued to provide information to international
right.
networks. So they pushed through that. It came out on the other side with a very vibrant free press.
Yeah.
Not a professional press, possibly, but the April 6th movement and many of the NGOs working on the ground are very careful to train their members to provide quality content and have that ready for the press.
Frank,
so they've come out on the other side of this, I think.
Frank, they endeavored, of course, to shut down the Internet. I like that expression, shut down the Internet, as if indeed it would be fully possible to do such a thing. But I want to come back to you. You, of course, have a very active Twitter page for those who want to check it out. Frank Smith with a Y. I'm sure you would want people to see it, so I'm saying that on the radio quite deliberately. But it is all about democracy, isn't it? As odd as that might sound, it's very clear that these governments, you know, many of the places that we talk about where journalists have been killed, it can be about organized crime, or it can be about, you know, various danger zones into which journalists are covering things that have nothing to do with democracy. But clearly, when we're talking about what has been happening in North Africa and the Middle East, it is about democracy and governments that recognize that journalism is a part of flourishing democracy. Is that not the case?
Well, what I think is clear is that these governments are trying to crush pro-democratic demonstrations by attacking the press. And this strategy has backfired in Egypt, and it's unclear whether it will work or the degree that it will succeed or backfire in other nations. But clearly, it's harder in an interconnected world for authorities and other actors to try and restrict the press out in the open, like we saw in Cairo and other cities, without paying a price, without information still managing to get out. So I think for regimes like Egypt, Miriam's right. They may start to realize that this isn't working. It may, in the end, backfire and give them only worse press. So hopefully they'll realize those mistakes and start backing off, at least in some cases. And that's what we're shooting for. And if not, we'll keep the pressure on if regimes continue acting in this way. In terms of the broader point, 20 years ago, more journalists were attacked for reporting on human rights abuses than almost anything else. In the past 10 years or so, and perhaps even longer, journalists are attacked more often for reporting on instances of corruption and collusion between corrupt government officials and organized crime. That's become one of the leading reasons that journalists who've been murdered have been murdered after they've been investigating these kinds of stories. And that occurs very much in the dark, unlike the more blatant attacks against the press that we've seen in recent weeks in Egypt and other nations. So it's important to keep a focus on these attacks that are occurring when the press is covering street demonstrations, but it's also important to keep in mind that journalists who are investigating or merely trying to report on wrongdoing, organized crime activities, corruption by government officials in a host of nations, that these are the journalists who are most often at risk. And like I said, they're getting murdered at a rate of one every 11 or so days, and in almost every case, or in 9 out of 10 cases, the killers get away with it.
Yeah, and the United Nations lists Pakistan, Mexico and Honduras as three of the worst countries for journalists on the ground, and we don't talk about it at all in the media, so at least this is shining a light on the dangers journalists face. Miriam Ashani, where can we follow your journalism, those of us who want to follow your important work there in Cairo?
Certainly. You can look for me at Reuters, on the video content in Reuters. And as well, I have a Twitter account as well, Miriam Ishani. And my company, Transterra Media, where you want to see my own work with the work of independent producers in places like Egypt. I wanted to just add one thing to what Frank just said, if possible. I don't know if we have time, but something I think that came up with the case of Lara Logan that I've seen over my years as a journalist, particularly for females, but I think with journalists across the board, is when something does go wrong for journalists, and Frank, I think you can speak to this as well, there is frequently a lack of sympathy because journalists are seen as putting themselves on an airplane and into the fray, that when things do go wrong, there's kind of a, well, you didn't have to be there attitude that I think Lara Logan I saw in some of the rhetoric around what happened to her, and as well with a colleague of mine who was kidnapped and held hostage in Somalia for 15 months, Amanda Lindhout, who you may have heard of. There's a lot of condemnation for independents, freelancers, that a lot of networks rely on. I've been a freelancer a long time as well, and I know how much networks rely on independent reporters, but frequently there isn't that sympathy as much as, for example, a tourist or someone who just happened to be there by accident.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought up Lara Logan, and I was thinking also of Yuna and Lee and Ling when they were on the border and got caught up in North Korea, and there was and is, I think, currently very little sympathy for women journalists out there covering very dangerous situations. What was your reaction, Miriam, to the Rosen tweet He's now apologized, but the Twitter rampage that occurred after, were you able to follow that?
I was, yes. I think I was impressed by NYU's response to that because I think it was very unacceptable. But I wasn't surprised in the very least. It was heartbreaking for me to watch, to see the language I saw in syndicated press speaking about my friend Amanda, as myself and her family worried about what would happen to her over a period of a year and a half. The rhetoric was so so unsympathetic and so unkind sometimes that she deserved this. It brought this upon herself for having gone to Somalia to cover the fate of refugees in that country. And that was heartbreaking. And I think I hope people condemn language like that, or at least, you know, or come back at it and say, we rely on these people to tell us these stories. We can't imagine the situation we'd be in if we didn't have people like that to go in. I think women particularly, around the time of this, it came up that, you know, of the women who've been reported to be attacked or assaulted on over the last few years, only a few respond with information about that, because I think women don't want to admit that they're maybe sometimes more vulnerable. They don't want to be passed up for assignments. They don't want to be thought of as not being able to do the job as well because they are physically vulnerable or for whatever reason. And so they hide it and they don't bring it out there for fear of being judged more harshly.
All right. I am going to have to leave it there. That in itself, I think, is a segment about women journalists overseas. We will think about that for a future segment. Wonderful two guests to join us today on a most important subject. The guests have been Frank Smith. He is with the Council to Protect Journalists. And, of course, you can read about that in today's New York Times. And also Reuters journalist who joined us from Cairo. Thanks to you both. And Miriam Ashani, please be safe.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. Pleasure, Miriam.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, mystery secrets and a new take on the old ghosts of Mississippi with the Injustice Files.